is it important to celebrate Juneteenth and the Ma'afa? Governor Westmore signs an historic burial ground law. Was the U.S. Supreme Court reversal of the Voting Rights Act predictable? Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm your host, Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, and I'm with you the fourth Wednesday of each month. Our first guest this morning is attorney Aristotle Teresa of Stoop Law. Attorney Teresa is a civil rights and land use attorney and adjunct professor at the American University School of Law. He is a Howard University school graduate. Ari is well known for his representation of Berry Farms. Attorney Teresa represents the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition in litigation against the self-storage company, namely 1784 Holdings, that's building on top of a sacred African burial ground. Welcome, Attorney Teresa, to What's at Stake.
Hi, thanks for having me, Marsha.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on again. When I heard about the Supreme Court decision to reverse the landmark Voting Rights Act, the first person I thought about was you. I knew you would have both a theoretical and practical perspective on this issue. And then I read a social media narrative that you wrote explaining how the system operates at both the macro and micro levels to disenfranchise African people. From my reading, you argue that the system is constantly readjusting and recalibrating to assure a form of disenfranchisement of Black people. You argue that the reversal of the Voting Rights Act by the U.S. Supreme Court is a part of this process, of this structure. Did I understand you correctly?
Yeah, I think that's correct. The system or the judicial system, it is a judicial system, but the structures that ensure our civil rights are kind of flawed from the outset, from the time that they're written to the time of their interpretation, to the time of their undoing.
Mm-hmm. Most people in our community have viewed the Voting Rights Act as the bedrock of the civil rights movement. It was a jewel in our crown. Dr. King, Reverend Abernathy, thousands of others marched and sacrificed and risked their lives, were murdered to ensure its passage. Little girls were murdered in a church bombing in Alabama to fight for basic human rights. Has this law been reversed?
I think yes, pretty much. The Voting Rights Act has had two components to it. One of them was disposed of, I think, over 10 years ago. I think it was 12 years ago. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was pre-authorization, where basically if a jurisdiction that was, I'm paraphrasing, but if a jurisdiction was part of Jim Crow, they had Jim Crow laws, then they had, if they were going to change their voting laws or, you know, how they drew up districts or anything like that, they had to go to a federal, they had to go to the feds to get approval before they did it. And so this was called pre-authorization, and that was struck down. And so what was recently struck down was Section 2. And Section 2 is something that happens after the change is made, whereas Section 5 happened before the change was made. But Section 2, you could kind of use it in a way. You could kind of use it to kind of fill in the gap, that the void that Section 5 left, but it would be after the fact. And that was applicable everywhere. It wasn't just applicable to the Jim Crow jurisdictions. You could use it in D.C. You could use it in Vermont. And so in a way, you know, that what they tried to get rid of in Section 5 through Section 5, when they got rid of it, it could be used elsewhere in other places. So it kind of grew even though they got rid of it. But it wasn't, again, it wasn't something that happened beforehand. It was something that happened afterward. And what would happen is, if somebody drew up something that was suspect or somebody wanted to question, they could challenge it under Section 2 and say, this is going to have a disparate impact on people. And, you know, there are like a list of factors that you had to go through to like prove or show that, one, this had a disparate impact, and two, it was subject to Section 2. And that included a historical analysis of the jurisdiction and, you know, its history with discrimination and all these things. It was really clumsy, clumsy statute. But that's what was gotten rid of, this idea that you need, that you can use this disparate impact to prove it, because without disparate impact, all you have is evidence of direct discrimination. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what gave Section 2 its teeth, is that, hey, even though I can't prove that you're being racist here, I can show you that, you know, this change that you're proposing is going to disparately impact a protected class of people, such as Black people, typically is what happens with these laws. But that was struck down. And so, was the Voting Act struck down? There's still certain portions of it that exist. And, you know, I think some of the things that our ancestors fought for still exist. Like, you wouldn't go in and have like a poll test, right? And then tell you that like you can't vote. But like the discrimination has become more sophisticated, you know, in terms of like how they do this stuff.
Right. Well, there aren't the bowling beans next to the bowling booth anymore.
Right.
I said there's just not a bowl of beans next to the voting booth anymore. But there are other ways of achieving the same result, though, right?
Exactly. And our laws, you know, whereas like maybe they had a fighting chance of like, you know, intercepting that, now I don't think that they do.
And just for our listeners who don't understand what a bowl of beans means, it means that before the Voting Rights Act, if people like my grandmother, my grandfather in Southern Ohio, when they would go to the polls to vote, there would literally be a bowl of beans there. And the election officials would ask them, how many beans are in this bowl? And then if they didn't get the answer right, and of course there was no right answer to that question, they weren't allowed to vote. Is that right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I think stuff like that is still illegal. But, you know, again, the issues that people have with voting now are a lot more sophisticated than that. And I think through the drawing of these maps, you know, that's kind of what we're seeing. And, you know, them saying that disparate impact doesn't apply, you know, really puts a kibosh on like what attorneys can do to stop this kind of thing.
Yeah, but you argue in your article, now really sort of focusing, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, so please, you know, please help us understand what you were writing. And you know, this is a Facebook entry, and the public can read this. And I would encourage everyone to read the essay that you wrote about this. My sense is that you're really arguing for a structural analysis as opposed to just looking at this particular incident as being an isolated situation. You write that this basically what you said is a system that we live under in the US is a system that, quote, is strategically designed to destroy and disempower. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I don't know. I don't know the I can guess the at the intent. What I can say is that the systems that we have are not designed, are not able or not capable of doing the things that needs to be done. So for instance, you look at a lot of our civil rights laws and like access to facilities and stuff like that. A lot of people think that that's rooted in something like, statements from our forefathers, and everyone's created equal and that kind of thing. But really, like when you look at, like why, why am I able to go into a restaurant in Wilmington, whereas, my grandparents couldn't? Why? And so when you look at, the legal rationale for that, it comes through the Commerce Clause, right? And so there's this friction between federal government and state government. And what the friction is state, America, they want to give states the ability to do the things that they want to do. And a lot of it, I think, is rooted in like this notion of like a king and, not wanting to have one, right? You see these protests now about that. But I think that, the US has some kind of a pathology over that because of, how it was created. And so, Congress is like hands tied. They're like looking at it and they're saying, well, how can we tell Mississippi what to do? And so instead of just, a very human way of looking at it, like black people are humans, they're citizens, they were born here, they should have rights. And this is wrong, right? And having some kind of like thinking around that. Instead of that, they say, well, you are, off of the interstate highway system and you benefit from the feds. And so the feds can, tell you what to do in this instance, right? And make laws about access to, things that are off the federal highway system. And so like it's this kind of like obfuscated thinking about civil rights and the way that people are able to engage with the promises of America. And I think that's the problem, because we don't, the beginning point isn't doesn't come from a human perspective almost. I think it more comes from well, I wouldn't even say a human perspective. I think all of this stuff is very human, but it doesn't come from like a perspective of equality. It comes from a perspective of projection, protecting against these pathologies that we have, or avoidance. And that's where it comes from, but not this notion of equality.
You're right. The law often retreats before it announces retreat. The time-limiting logic was already visible. You could hear it in the voting rights cases, the affirmative action cases, and abortion doctrine. The language changed across subjects, but the structure remained familiar. Remedies often justified by severe harm become suspect as soon as the courts decide the country may have changed, the remedy may have done its work, or continued attention to structural inequality may itself have become unfair. So how can communities fight a system that justifies severe harm as an instrument of control and structural inequality as a readjustment tool? I mean, you argue that seeds of what we're experiencing now were dropped years before the Supreme Court announced its decision on the Voting Rights Act. Just one more quote. You wrote in Gutter 2023, Justice O'Connor wrote that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary. A fuse set in 2003, Students for Fair Admissions lit it in 2023 with 2 years still on the timer.
Right. And so you'll see this in a lot of these laws and these civil rights laws that people use, or even human rights laws that are used in the country. So with the Voting Rights Act, I worked on that in 2008 when I was at Howard Law School. Section 5 was under attack at that point, and they didn't get rid of it till 2013. But it first came to a district court in 2008, and they were talking about it. The Supreme Court refused to rule on it at that point. But I remember in one of the opinions, they were talking about Obama and saying that, you know, hey, like, we live in a different country now. Obama's been elected. He's a black president. Like, do we really need these Jim Crow laws on the book? And so, like, the tension again is this conflict between feds and the state. Like, do the feds have the right to sit a commission or board on top of this vote, this state, and tell them what they can do with their voter laws? And so they were saying, well, the country's changed. We don't need to do this, right? And so the perspective always is, you know, rather than ensuring that people have rights or that people's rights are respected in this country, no matter the race, you know, it always starts from this question of, you know, how is this going to impact the American project? And if it's going to impact it negatively, then maybe we can, like, engage with it a little bit, but we have to put limits on it. It can't last forever, you know, because the American project is more important than that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you have there, you know, Obama was elected, the country's changed. And then by the time, you know, we get here, you know, Section 5's gone, Section 2's gone, and the whole time is you're saying America's changed. We know it hasn't. You know, at this point, you know, I don't even think that was in this order that America had changed. I think that they had that in 2013 when he said it. You know, they did that with the affirmative action laws. You know, before they got rid of it, they just were like, well, you know, we can do this, you know, we can sustain this for this amount of time. And then, you know, then they got rid of it. So I think that's the issue, is that, you know, that there's this notion of, like, what America is. And, you know, that's of the utmost importance.
So what is the American project? Since you mentioned it, you've mentioned it twice. How do you define the American project?
I would define it as just, you know, America is a country where people went in the very beginning. You know, it's just like romanticized. You know, avoiding who they thought were tyrants, or, you know, coming here looking for opportunity, or money and wealth, and adventure. And I think that's the project. And I think when you start you know, trying to engineer a society that is equal to people who are different from you, you know, particularly, you know, racially, you know, America's always been part of like a racialized economy. You know, I think that rubs up against the, you know, American project, which is really, you know, in many ways about lawlessness and like doing, you know, what you want to do.
I just wanted to also mention, because it's in your article, and you said in Northwest Austin, 2009, Chief Justice Roberts noted that, quote, things have changed in the South. 4 years later in Shelby County, he made it a holding. Quote, nearly 50 years later, things have changed dramatically. Warning shot in 2009, operative ruling in 2013. So there are all these salvos that go out so many years before the change actually happens. Are we looking at these people like, you know, members of the Supreme Court? I know in Democracy Now! Before this show, they talked about oligarchy. But are we looking at this ruling class that's organized, designing what you call the American project, constantly interacting, trying to renegotiate, recalibrate how they maintain the structure of the American project?
I'm sorry, you broke up a little bit.
No, I was wondering how this calibration takes place, how these individual actors, whether they're Supreme Court judges or whether they're politicians or entrepreneurs, are somehow designing and redefining the American project, and quite frankly, and making sure that certain people are not a part of the wealth of this country from one generation to the next generation, or part of the laws that protect populations from one generation to the next.
Well, I think it's just something that, you know, is passed down. You know, you go to these schools, a lot of these elite institutions, and, you know, you're taught doctrines and you're taught ways of thinking. And, you know, I'm not even sure that, it may just be something that's subconscious at this point, something that, you know, people just do.
Well, you know, you talk about it as penance. That there's this penance for the sins of the father. And you write that civil rights remedies are seen as temporary punishment for past national sins,
right,
rather than permanent infrastructure for democratic life.
Right. Yeah. And that's what it is. I think that, you know, America has no problem because, you know, on the one hand, you know, America is about racialized capitalism, is about, you know, escaping tyranny, is about freedom, you know, and is about every man being equal. And so all of these things kind of run in conflict with each other. And I think the U.S. has no problem seeing where, you know, in the past, they may have run afoul of like some of their principles. And so, you know, they'll, you know, from time to time, write laws to attempt to correct for that. But, you know, those laws are never written with the intention of like changing the underlying structure. And they're even suspicious of these laws if they have the power to do that. And so they don't want them to be powerful, like, you know, like how I'm able to go into a restaurant because, you know, they avail themselves of, you know, the interstate commerce system and through the Commerce Clause. You know, that's something that, you know, it's something, but it's also not, you know, in conflict with, like, I guess, the greater system. And it's also something that is, you know, it's not solid. It's not a solid foundation to build from for permanent rights. You know, and so you do stuff like that. So you still have a lot of, you know, private discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is not covered by.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And so it's just, you know, I think that America, you know, needs to dig deeper, right, than what they've done.
What I really also really valued in your essay, in your Facebook essay, is that, you know, you talk about the fact that many essays and comments on the reversal of the Voting Rights Act focus on particular actors. But one of the things that you didn't do in your Facebook essay is you never mentioned President Trump. You didn't mention him one time, but you focused on the genetics of the system, the DNA of the system. You want to explain, because most of the conversations on the reversal deals with the White House, president, the Congress, but you didn't do that. You focused on something quite different.
Yeah, I mean, it was inevitable. They got rid of it. They got rid of Section 5 in 2013. And all that was left was Section 2, and it kind of grew Section 5. So Section 5 was limited to a few states. And without that, you know, people were able to use people turned to Section 2, and then it expanded beyond those few states. So they got rid of something almost 15 years ago because they didn't want it. And now that thing has like grown. So, you know, it just seemed obvious to me that they were going to, that was going too. And, you know, is Trump the cause of that? I don't know. I've heard people blame, RGB, the RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, yeah, who didn't retire, you know, who didn't retire when everyone wanted her to, and they blamed her. But like, to me, these things are just, you know, it's kind of just like a machine, you know, working and building up its momentum. And yeah, Trump is a part of that for sure. But it's also kind of inevitable.
We only have a few more minutes, and I want to get to a couple of other. One of the things that I thought was particularly poignant in your essay, you said, "I grieved the Voting Rights Act in 2013, and I knew more of it was going away." And you write later, "The deeper problem is a failure of imagination. America has never been especially elegant about equality, because it has never wanted equality badly enough to imagine it clearly. Black political power is treated as something to administer and contain rather than as an ordinary condition of democratic life."
Right. And that's what I mean by, you know, they don't want to, you know, when it comes to our rights in this country, they don't want to expand it to the point to where their system feels threatened or their way of doing things feels threatened. And so it's always, you know, contained, you know, well, we'll give this 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the country's changed, it's no longer like that anymore. And so it's really heavily scrutinized instead of being actually a part of the country's mythos. It's actually scrutinized and limited.
Right. Well, we've run out of time, but this is obviously a very powerful essay. And people can access it through your Facebook page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Ari Teresa's Facebook page. I would recommend that everyone take a look at this. It's a very powerful essay, and we still have only just scratched the surface of it. So thank you so much for what is clearly a very brilliant essay, and thank you for your work as a civil rights attorney.
All right, thank you, Marcia.
Thank you. And we'll take a break for the social justice calendar.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of May 25th, 2026. Wednesday, May 27th is Pan-African Community Action's next Asada Shakur Study Group session. From D.C. to the Diaspora, African Liberation Day and the Struggle for Power. A discussion from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Black Workers and Wellness Center on 2500 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More info and registration is on postald2026.eventbrite.com. On Thursday, May 28th, from 5 to 8 p.m., Youth for Justice and Arts in Action, in partnership with D.C. Girls Coalition, invites youth ages 13 and up for a D.C. panel and workshop at Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, 5301 North Capitol Street, Northeast D.C. They will center youth voices on the Free D.C. platform, the work of true safety, and the importance of the youth in the Free D.C. movement. Thursday, May 28th is the Report Back webinar on the first ever global conference on fossil fuels with U.S. movement organizers who will discuss outcomes for the movement in relation to the climate crisis from 8 to 9:30 p.m. More info and registration can be found on ips-dc.org/events. Finally, on Thursday, May 28th, from 7 to 9 p.m., Africa World Now Project and Bloom Bars present the film Legacy, Apartheid Shadow by Tara Moore, followed by a post-screening discussion with the filmmaker at Bloom Bars, 3222 11th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. More info at www.bloombars.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Social justice submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Good morning again. My name is Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, and you are listening to What's at Stake on WPFW. My next guest is Josh Silvers. He's the legislative director for the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition and author of a book on redlining. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Marsha. Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you. Can you give us the exact title of your book?
Sure. Ending Redlining Through a Community-Centered Reform of the Community Reinvestment Act. And CRA was a law designed to end redlining and empower communities in working with banks to finance affordable housing and community development.
And where can people find your book?
If you just type in Google, Josh Silver, End Redlining, and it also has a website. And I hope some people look at it.
Yeah, it's a very, very important book, and it's a good read as well. So thank you very much for coming on this morning. On May 12th, Governor Wes Moore signed into law a bill that you worked literally day and night. I think you talk about having Pepto-Bismol by your nightstand, namely SB 233. This bill came out of the struggle to stop the ongoing desecration of Moses African Cemetery in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm sure you have a number of people that you wish to thank, but first, could you explain what protections and rights this law now affords vulnerable communities attempting to prevent greedy developers from desecrating and owning their personal and sometimes community burial grounds and the remains of their loved ones?
Sure. But this also relates a little bit to redlining, because when a community has experienced discrimination when they're living, often what happens is there's discrimination and death. And I've been a member of the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition for a number of years and have really enjoyed working closely with Marsha and others. When an African-American community is displaced through KKK violence or discrimination, oftentimes the only thing that remains is one, the church, and the parishioners don't live there anymore. They live all over the DMV. And a desecrated cemetery, a cemetery that has fallen into the hands of developers. And in the case of Moses African Cemetery, there's light industry, there's a parking lot, and there's an apartment building over parts of Moses African Cemetery. So the reason why we went to Annapolis and it got a state law passed is existing state law does not provide adequate protections for vulnerable and historic cemeteries. The existing state, the way a civil rights law works, like the Fair Housing Act, if you feel like you've been discriminated against, you go to court and you have your day in court. But in the case of desecrated cemeteries, the existing state law says you can go to court, but it's going to be really hard, and the court doesn't even have a requirement to make a decision on the case. So we decided to work on SB 233 and to say we need a civil rights law in the case of death, that a dissenting community like the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition has a right to go to court, and the court must make a decision in 6 months. Some of the listeners may know, there is a case right now, Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition versus the Housing Opportunities Commission of Montgomery County. That case has gone on for 6 years because the standing or the right to sue of BACC has been challenged, and the court was spent a number of years just deciding whether it even needs to decide on the case. So we say no, 6 years is justice delayed and justice denied, and we need a court to make an expeditious decision in 6 months. So that is the law today.
Wow.
In Maryland.
That's impressive because, you know, not very many communities could have survived for 6 years. If you're paying attorney's fees, if you're paying, you know, just in terms of the natural migration and just changes in a community, it's almost a recipe for not having these cases move forward. It's basically a war of attrition against the community, right? Because you don't have what it takes to stand up to multi-million dollar corporations that have that kind of longevity. So this law is, I think the governor sees this law as very historic. And yesterday, of course, maybe you could talk about the seminar that we had yesterday with the lead delegate, state delegate, Terry Hill, who ushered this law through the Maryland State Assembly, the General Assembly.
Sure. So you need essentially two ingredients to get a law, and it's very hard work. One ingredient is you need dedicated elected officials. And the second ingredient is you need a powerful coalition, grassroots coalition, that has access to the elected officials, in part because they have members that call and email their elected officials. And we were lucky to have both. The Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, there was also a coalition based in Baltimore called the Maryland Cemetery Legislative Advocates. And we also had real champions in the State House. We had on the Senate side, we had a bipartisan bill. There was a Republican state senator, Johnny Ray Solling, who thought this was very important. It's a human rights issue. And then on the House side, we had Delegate Terry Hill. And not only is she brilliant, and we found that out last night, how brilliant she is, but she's also a tenacious negotiator at each part of the bill. And there were during the legislative session, there was a possibility that the existing law was going to be weakened. But Terry Hill said no, and said to the Senate side, we can't weaken this bill. And she held firm. We don't have a perfect bill. Hopefully we can go back and close some of the loopholes. But we do believe we have an advance, and that is because you have Very dedicated lawmakers working with a coalition of grassroots advocacy organizations.
Can you talk about the issue of standing? Because one would think that if a community approached lawmakers or the court and wanted to make sure that their loved ones were safe from being destroyed, that there was a community that supported that, that would initiate, or that would be considered, that this community would have standing before a court to negotiate these issues. But standing was not automatic in this case. And we had to, in fact, fight for descendant groups to have standing before a court. Could you explain that?
Well, it's, you know, you remember the comedian David Letterman, and he talked about stupid pet tricks on his show. This is like stupid defendant tricks that a powerful interest, like a corporation, they will always try to do this, that the plaintiffs don't have standing, they can't prove harm. And that's absurd on its face, because a descendant community has loved ones buried in the cemetery. So what the law does, very simply, and you know, at the top of the law, is it specifies who has standing, and descendant communities have standing. Persons of interest, people who have their loved ones buried in the cemetery, have standing. A nonprofit organization, it's not necessarily a descendant organization, but pledges to maintain and preserve the cemetery, a nonprofit will have standing. And one of the Republican lawmakers who worked with us, a delegate, Seth Howard, was an advocate of veterans. So veterans organizations now have standing. So to make it explicit, hopefully we overcome the stupid defendant trick.
Right. Now, there are people who are not happy with this new law that's in place. The governor has signed it. One is the Catholic Church. And a lot of people are very surprised that the Catholic Church decided to oppose this bill, now a law. So how do you explain that the Catholic Church came out with this position?
Well, there were two formidable opponents we had to overcome. One was the Housing Opportunities Commission, we just talked about in the lawsuit. And their supposition is, if you have this law where descendant communities can now go to court, we will not be able to build affordable housing fast enough to deal with the housing crisis in Montgomery County. And is it plausible that there are so many cemeteries in Montgomery County, there's no room to build housing and affordable housing? Just seems implausible. They didn't offer any statistics in their testimony. So that was relatively easy to overcome. But the other opponent we did not completely overcome was the Catholic Church. And it was very surprising. People were shocked by it. But there are a lot of churches that have cemeteries, but some churches are going out of business. They've lost their parishioners over the years, and they want to sell their cemetery. But what's shocking to those of us who are not familiar with this, who are not Catholics, is they don't really want any oversight when they sell their cemeteries. And we're like, no, you're human beings, even though you might be a priest in a church. And we need to make sure that there is ultimate accountability to the descendants. And when that's, because there have been cases in Maryland, neglected Catholic cemeteries. Marsha, you talk about the history of segregated Catholic cemeteries and the African-American section not being taken care of. Unfortunately, the final bill has an exemption for religious organizations. They are not subject. First, there is a process where there's sort of a state agency that oversees a sale. And then if you don't like what the state agency does, you can go to court. Where the religious organization is, religious institutions that own cemeteries are exempt from both, exempt from the state agency oversight and exempt from the court process. So we're going to try to change that. Delegate Terry Hill was surprised that this made the final bill. She thought it was going to be out. And hopefully we can get enough religious institutions the next legislative session to come out and say, this is an important protection that should apply in all cases.
Right. And the church should not be exempt from that. Just wanted to, I know you wanted to shout out some thank yous to people who helped you. Mm-hmm. And we only have a minute, but who did you want to thank?
Sure. Well, it takes a village. And first of all, Maryland Cemetery Legislative Advocates, David Zinner, Eileen McGookian, there's a lot of other great advocates. Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition, we couldn't have done it without the persistent struggle of Marsha Coleman Adebayo, Reverend Segun Adebayo, Bobby Mosi, Thomas Blanton, and Brother Matthew Harvey. Without his testimony and firsthand experiences, we probably wouldn't be here today. So thank you, Brother Harvey. And, you know, I'm a Jewish American, and I can tell you the desecration of and the annihilation of Jewish communities in Europe. So this is why this hits home to me, that we must preserve history and teach it so it never happens again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you. And I thank you so much for all of your hard work and the nights that you couldn't sleep. Well, I don't thank you for that, but I'm sorry for that. But I'm happy that you put in the time, the effort, the passion, the love to make sure this, getting a bill passed through a state house or through the federal government, is a big deal.
It's like
passing a kidney stone. So we thank you so much. We hope you didn't have to pass a kidney stone. but we thank you so much for all of your effort. And we look forward to working with you again.
Absolutely. Thank you, Marsha.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So our next guest is Thomas Blanton with the National Juneteenth Commemoration Committee and WPFW. And Baba Mosi Metsamela, president of UNIA, ACL, Whitson Banneker, Jackson Bay Division 330. Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning.
Good morning, Mama Ngozi.
Good morning. Good morning, Thomas.
Yes.
Thomas, can you hear
you're
us?
Muted.
Oh, he's muted, yes. Thomas, you're muted.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Maybe he's trying to unmute. So why don't we start with you, Baba Mosi, and maybe our engineer can send Thomas a note to let him know that he's muted. Baba Mosi, can you talk a little bit about the Juneteenth? Why? I mean, it's become very popular now. It's in the last, I'd say, 5 years, Juneteenth has become, not only is it a national holiday, but it's now become, I think, an emotional holiday for a lot of people in this country. And by the way, they are celebrating Juneteenth in Ghana this year as well.
I got it.
Wow.
Yeah. So can you? Oh, thank you, Thomas. You're with us. Can you both talk a little bit about why Juneteenth has now become such a major holiday for the Black community?
Marsha, I'm sorry I blew my opening, but I still want to recover.
That's okay. Baba Mosi, you want to start?
Okay. Well, you know, as you said earlier about this emotional issue of Juneteenth at this time, you know, it's a testimony to what's been going on in history, of historical factors of, you know, people not feeling the July 4th independence and all that stuff that was being propagandized by the historical societies of the U.S. and even governments. You know, for African people, there was no real feeling of being independent. And so when we got that Juneteenth to help hold on to it as something to celebrate, it got into the chest of people. That it was like an emotive statement. Juneteenth, they were feeling it because they don't feel July 4th. So and in a sense, it's a great thing for those of us as Africans in the Americas that to have something like that. But we're celebrating a 2-year gap from the real date that Africans were enslaved. Africans were given their freedom, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Today, however, we should be able to do more, but we're still psychologically attached to Juneteenth. We're celebrating it because the impact of it on African people has been great. We still don't recognize or feel have that emotive feeling about July 4th. Thomas may tell you so a little bit more because he's organized with all these people in the country. So, Thomas, can I switch that over to you and then we can come back?
Baba, most love you, brother. The people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with the proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. And the connection therefore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freemen are advised to remain quietly at their present homes and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect at military posts and that they will not be supported in idleness either there or elsewhere. Can you imagine being enslaved for one, two, three generations and finally having the right to be free? Those of us who've always enjoyed our freedom, we have a different perspective on that. But on that day, at least about 3,000 people in the Galveston territory, because we're going to talk about why that's not true, that Texans didn't find out. I'm a Texan. I'm a sixth-generation Texan. My great-grandparents' house is about 115 miles from Galveston. They already knew that the war was going on. They already knew that the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed, and they already knew that they were fighting for their freedom. It just so happens that Galveston is an island, and there was a large plantation on that island. And those people in that immediate area, you know, were not released. Let me stop before I go on to the rest of that history that we can discuss. But my point is, one, we celebrate it because it is a day that was marked for a lot of people, you know, and it is a day that was fought for, and it is a day that people died for. I say, shut up, Thomas.
No, I don't want you to shut up, Thomas. I think what you're saying is just so important. And I'm glad that you read that order because many people have not heard that order before. And it really set up in many ways, sort of a new form of, you know, enslavement or whatever, because they said now instead of being quote unquote a slave, now you're going to have employer and employees. And of course, we're the employees and the people who were holding us illegally were the employers. But it's important that people hear that. And you can imagine the kind of visceral reaction that people had. Like, there was a movement going. There was some movement going. And it was going in a way that was away from the people who had been torturing them. So it's a very important, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. So I really want to get to activities. We have African Liberation Day coming up as well as Juneteenth. Baba Mosey, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. Well, those of us, the UNIA Division 330 Rehabilitating Committee 2020, we are in partnership with the Grand United Order of Odd Fellows Lodge out there in Sandy Spring. And we're going to be having a celebration there, African Celebration Day. I mean, Liberation Day. Could be called Celebration Day as well. As opposed to Africa Day, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say, I have no feeling, especially because Africa Day sounds so commercial, because this is like how they changed the OAS to AU, which is copying a European style thing. And now you have this Africa Day that's erasing these liberation movements, because you're not talking about liberation. You're saying Africa Day, which can be changed.
No, we only have 1 minute left, though.
Right? Okay. All right. Well, let me say this. We will have a lot of speakers out there Sandy Spring Road, 1308. We're going to have speakers. We're going to have drummers. We're going to have music. We're going to have a lot of fun.
What time does this start?
Marshall, we're going to see you on the 19th at Glen Echo Park. Is that correct?
Right. I'll be at the Juneteenth, the BACC Juneteenth at Glen Echo Park. Mm-hmm. And then also we have a Ma'afa. What is
I'm going to go back to that. I just want to make sure I cover my territory.
Sure. Thomas, what is Ma'afa?
Ma'afa is the celebration of the tragedies, the deaths of those who have fallen before. You know, it's an opportunity for us to remember our ancestors. You know, we're going to have the participation of the United States Colored Troops led by Captain Gant, and we're going to have others planting the flag, the Juneteenth flag, red, blue, and white.
Red, blue, and white.
And so it's important for us to come out and remember again, you know, those who have gone before us, before we just celebrate.
Absolutely.
We have participation from groups like Black Workers Center over on Martin Luther King Avenue, All Souls Church, and Time to Get Involved, a group that meets at Shiloh to organize, and Ben's Chili Bowl. They have the June 20th. They're celebrating all day over at Shiloh Baptist Church. So we want people to come out, you know, get informed. We are still organizing, so there's an opportunity for people to be involved in these different organizations. We're going to be at the African American Civil War Plaza on the 14th, reading the names of the 2,909 soldiers. We read the names according to the event, so Frank's going to get me on that.
You know, okay.
It's about 3,000 soldiers that participated in the Emancipation Proclamation and the March on Galveston.
Right.
So we'll read the names of those to be remembered.
Thank you so much. This is a lot of wonderful activity, a lot of wonderful activities. I know we're out of time today. Just, there's another concert at Rise Zone on June 3rd at 6:30. Also associated with Juneteenth. Please, our sister Freedom will be singing, and other Jamal Gray and Mia and the Agonauts. So it's a lot of really wonderful activities around the city for this important holiday. So thank you so much, you know, Baba Mosey, Thomas Blanton. We're so grateful for all of your work. And thank you so much for coming on the show today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guests.
Heartfelt thank you to all our WPFW donors, both new and returning, for your incredible support during our recent Spring Pledge Drive. Your generosity helps amplify the sounds of emancipatory music and movements. If you haven't had the chance to donate yet, now is the time. Please visit WPFWFM.org to help us close the $79,000 gap between our goal and what we've raised. It's listeners like you who keep a song in our heart and independent music and journalism thriving at WPFW, ensuring that jazz and justice reach everyone. Thank you for being part of our community.
DC Abortion Fund, Burger Sounds, and Noise for Now present the fourth annual My Body, My Festival on Thursday, May 28th at the 930 Club, featuring Yaya Bey, Barty Strange, Nourished by Time, Deacon, Hamilton Lighthouser, and Cherub Tree. Info at mybodymyfestival.com.
WPFW, Washington, 89.3 FM.